thank y'all so much for asking me to be here tonight. I'm thankful that Henderson considered me and asked me to do this. Not really sure why, but I do appreciate the opportunity. I'm sure y'all have heard all about it this semester, about the sixth man in basketball. But for those of you that might be visitors and may not know what it is, on the first slide I have this picture. It was the best one I could find. But on this slide, there is a picture of... I'm trying to figure out how to change them. Oh, there we go. Look at that. Oh, that's the issue. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, great start, guys. on this first slide, I have a picture of the six-man winners. It's from, 2017. And the six-man in basketball from... I'm not a big basketball guy. I don't know that much about it, but... The sixth man in basketball, from what I could tell, is the that first player on your bench where you've got your five guys on the court and it's the first player on the bench, and whenever you need to pull somebody off and sub somebody in, that sixth man sitting on that bench is somebody that you need to be able to put in and put on that court who's going to make an impact. Way back when, years ago in basketball, whenever you sub people in, a lot of times as a coach, you'd be like, you know, what's this guy going to do? This is probably going to hurt us more than he's going to help us because my best players are on the court right now. But as people in the NBA got better and better, they found the need that this guy they put in, they can't afford for him not to be great. They can't afford for whenever they put him in the court, for that short amount of time that they put him in on that court, for him not to make an impact, for him not to make a change on that court, and he could turn the tide of the game. If you aren't already there, we're going to be in the book of Ruth tonight. Chapters 1 through 4 is where this story happens. The book of Ruth is fairly short, but the story that goes on here is a story told over years of someone's life, of several people's lives. And it's a story that is an amazing story. I've loved it. I've used it so much in different things that I've done. But basically what we see here in the book of Ruth is, in Ruth chapter 1, he gives a setting. And it says, in the days of the judges. And this is Ruth and Naomi. This is Naomi starting off here with her husband Elimelech. And they have two sons, Kilion and, I can't even say his name, Mahlon. I don't know their names. It's like Mahlon and Kilion. But Kilion and Mahlon and Elimelech and Naomi, and they're there in the land of Israel, and a great famine strikes Israel. And as this famine strikes Israel, they decide, you know, we have nothing going for us here. We've heard there's more food in Moab. Let's go there. So Elimelech and Naomi, they pick up their family and they move to the land of Moab, which is a land that they're foreign in. It's not really, you know, friends of Israel. And they move there and they go to work, and they work in fields and they get jobs, and they're trying to make a living, just trying to make ends meet, trying to survive. And while they're there, Elimelech, the father of the family, passes away. And so after Elimelech passes away, Naomi is just her and her two sons. And her two sons, after their father has died, find these two women, these Moabites, these two women, and they marry them. Their names are Orpah and Ruth. And Orpah and Ruth marry Naomi's two sons, and they become daughter-in-laws to Naomi, and years pass by, and I think it maybe says, you know, some time passes, like 10 years or something like that passes, and Naomi's two sons pass away. So she was in Israel, and a famine happened. They moved to Moab looking for something better, the land of Moab, not Moab, the land of Moab. They moved there looking for something better. And once they got there, her husband dies, her two children die, and now it's just her and two other females. Her two daughter-in-laws aren't even blood related to her. And Naomi hears that, you know, this famine is starting to end in Israel, and now there's more food, that there's food back in Israel. She says, look, there's nothing left for me here in Moab. I'm just going to go back, but y'all need to stay here. She goes to this whole deal with Orpah and Ruth and talks about how, look, you know, Israelite, if you come to Israel, you're going to be foreign people. People aren't going to really like you. They're not going to want you there. She says, you know, you've still got a young life. It's going to be a long time if I ever get married again. And if I do, it's going to be a much longer time before I can have children that can be raised up and that you can marry again. And she's trying to give them all these reasons that make logical sense, that you just need to stay here, leave me be. I'll go back by myself to Israel, and I'll figure something out. I'll work it out. And Orpah and Ruth both refused at first. And they said, no, look, we're going to stick with you. Whenever we married your two sons, we married your family as a whole. We're going to stick with you. And Naomi keeps on, and she keeps on going and giving them reasons, saying, look, this isn't going to work. And finally, Orpah says, okay, I will. This makes sense. And Orpah, you know, gives her a hug goodbye and a kiss and says, you know, I love you. I'm going to go back to my family. I'm going to go back to live with my parents and try and find someone else to marry. And Ruth, instead of doing that, And what we talk about so many times with the book of Ruth, whenever we hear lessons, it's about what Ruth does. Ruth and that act of loyalty that she shows to Naomi. And Ruth says, no. That's where we get those famous lines, you know, where you go, where I will go, your people will be my people, your God, my God. And Ruth and Naomi have this, and this act of loyalty that she has, that she shows to Naomi, and that shows Ruth's character and how she is as a person. And so Ruth and Naomi go back to Israel, and they get to Israel, and they're still struggling to make ends meet because it's two women in the time of the Old Testament. And so they're struggling to do what they can. And, you know, Naomi's still struggling over the loss of her husband. Ruth's still struggling over the loss of her husband as well. They're in here in Israel struggling around. And Ruth is wearing these, you know, black clothes, I assume. They're garments, they're clothing that are saying, you know, I'm not really available right now. I'm mourning a loss. And they're just trying to make ends meet. So Ruth, one day, after her and Naomi talk, goes out into a field. And she goes out, and she's starting to glean in the field. And whenever you glean in the field, you're going and you're picking up whatever's left over. Whenever you're doing the harvest, you go and you pick up the leftover food in the field. And I had Dalton read in our scripture reading. It was in chapter 2, I think verses 3 through 6. It says, and as Ruth went out into the field, she just so happened to end up in the part of the field that belonged to Boaz. And it just so happens that Boaz is a relative of Naomi and their family. And we'll get back to that later. And so they go in this field, and Ruth is there, and Boaz approaches. He comes from wherever he's been, and he walks up to one of his servants, and he says, who is this young girl in my field? And the servant explains, you know, this is the girl who came back from Moab, where she showed a great act of loyalty to Naomi, and he explains her story. He explains her story to Boaz, and Boaz shows compassion. He finds compassion, and he goes out of his way. He goes out of his way to make sure that whatever they need, whatever Ruth and Naomi need, they've got. They've got as much food as they need. He invites her in her house, gives her supper, says, look, you stay in my field and you glean there. Because if you go to somebody else's field, someone might hurt you. Some men may come after you. But you stay there. You stay with my people, with my servants, with all my family. You can stay with us. We're going to protect you. We're going to take care of you. And Boaz and Ruth goes back home to Naomi. And whenever she goes home, Naomi finds out what has happened. And Naomi is just overjoyed because Ruth has gone into this field and just so happened to meet their kinsman redeemer. And she says, you know, Ruth, you understand what you've done. You've met our kinsman redeemer. And in Bible times, the kinsman redeemer, you can give a whole sermon on the kinsman redeemer, all the different things that went down in that. Basically, whenever something would happen to your family, the loss of a husband, of a brother, or something like that, your job as the kinsman redeemer was to pick up that family, carry on the family name, and carry on all the family stuff like land and their property and their house and everything like that. And she, you know, Naomi gets overjoyed and says, look, you know, you've done this. This is great. You need to go back. And she says, you know, Ruth, you need to change these, you need to change out of your clothes, change out of these clothes in the morning. It's a time to rejoice. You need to go back to Boaz. Boaz is at the threshing floor, apparently, and he's asleep. And Ruth goes back dressed in normal clothes, you know, saying that I'm now available. I'm now willing to date you and marry you. And she lays at the feet of Boaz, and Boaz wakes up startled. He's like, what in the world are you doing laying at my feet? And Ruth wakes up and she explains everything that's going on, and Boaz is like, that's great. He said, I'll help you out. He makes promises to her. He says, I will marry you. I will help the family out. And so this goes on. We're getting to the end of the story here in chapter 4. And just so happens that Boaz meets another man who's actually also related to the family Naomi. And in chapter 4, where he meets this other man, or it could be the end of chapter 3, and he meets him and he says, you know, look, you're next in line before me to receive this inheritance from the family. Do you want to be the kinsman redeemer? And he's like, yeah, that's great. I'll take all their land. I'll do that. That sounds like a great deal for me. As it goes down, Boaz assembles people. He assembles some elders from the city and stuff like that. And he sits down. He does something with the sandal. It was something you used to do back then whenever you're making a transaction. And the guy that Boaz, I don't think it gives us his name, but the guy that Boaz has found, he's like, that's great. I'll take the land. And then he says, but you're also going to have to marry Ruth. And the guy says, well, no, that's not going to work for me. He said, that's a little too much commitment. I wanted what that was. I wanted the stuff that I could get out of this. I'm not wanting to marry somebody and do that kind of stuff. It's going to hurt my inheritance. And so he says, no. Boaz fulfills the promise. Boaz marries Ruth, is the kinsman redeemer of the family. And we end the book of Ruth with a great act of loyalty from Boaz, who is a noble character. And it matches the great act of loyalty from Ruth, who had noble character. I tell you all this because I wanted to just run through that very quickly, because I know a lot of you probably know the story of Ruth and Naomi, But there's a lot of details in there, and I know that was long and, you know, kind of boring, but I wanted to make sure, because I'm going to go back to some of these things that I've said. So, when starting off, we're going to look at a few different questions here tonight concerning Boaz. One of the first things that I want to look at is this: why should I want to be a Boaz in someone's life? We know we can look at the Great Commission in Matthew 28, verses 16 through 20. God expects us to be a Boaz in people's lives. Go into all the world, you know, baptize in the name of the Father. He expects us to do that. God wants us to do it. So if you're looking for a reason for, you know, just first off, why should I want to be a Boaz in someone's life? Because God commands us to do it. Because we love God, we want to do what he wants us to do. And we'll get back to our why here a little later. So my first thing that we're going to address is, how do I be a Boaz in someone's life? If you're thinking about Boaz in the book of Ruth and all that he does, the great act of commitment and loyalty that he shows, that each one of us is supposed to be like that, first off, how do we be a Boaz? Well, we're going to look at it here. Number one, you're going to have to recognize the opportunity. Boaz, one of the first things he did was recognize the opportunity in front of him. Boaz saw a girl in his field, and he approached the servant and said, you know, who is this? And the servant explained the story. He explained the situation to him, and Boaz saw an opportunity there. He recognized his opportunity to make a difference, to be a sixth man in someone's life. So whenever you're going throughout life, throughout your day, whenever you come into people in your life that God's put there and you may not notice it, you've got to recognize your opportunity before you can do anything else. Whenever you see someone at the store, in the office, who's kind of upset, somebody on our floor in our dorms is upset, somebody in class, somebody in chapel, wherever it is that you're at, you got to see somebody, you've got to recognize their opportunity. The second thing that you've got to do is respond to the opportunity. And this is the important part where the words and the thoughts meet the action. And you've got to respond to this opportunity like Boaz did. We see that Boaz, if you read through the second and the third chapter, you see all that Boaz does. I mean, this man goes out of his way. It's unreal what he does for them. I mean, you know, a lot of times in life, somebody, you know, we say, how are you doing? And somebody drops something heavy on us, and we're like, oh, I didn't really want to know that. And, you know, Boaz had that opportunity where he found out about her story and what was happening, and he went out of his way. He gave them food. He gave her protection. He gave them shelter. He gave them clothing. He did so much for them, and he eventually became their kinsman redeemer and helped them live a brand new life. Number three, what you've got to do is follow through and follow up. When we're talking about following through and following up, Boaz, I made a point when I was explaining kind of the story, trying to give you an overview of the story. Boaz made promises to Ruth. And he said, look, no matter what, at the end of the day, I'm going to make sure you get some help. At the end of the day, I will be your kinsman redeemer if no one else will. He says, but I found this other guy who's next in line to do it. And this other guy says, no, I'm not going to do it. So Boaz follows through on his promises. He follows through on the commitment that he's made to her. And the other thing that Boaz does is he follows up with her. Boaz didn't just see this girl in his field and just find out about her story and say, you know, I just want you to know, I really hope that works out for you. And get it, you know, I hope your life becomes better and that it gets worked out. And, you know, maybe gives her, you know, some money, maybe gives her some more of that grain and stuff that she was picking up and then leaves. You know, he followed up with her. Boaz kept coming back, kept going back, trying to help. He went back to her and gave her things, invited her into her house and did things like that. So why does all this matter? The most important part of these three quick things I've given you, and we've got a little bit more after this, is this. Is that you've got to be willing to recognize the opportunity. Remember that first step I said was recognize the opportunity, respond to the opportunity, and follow through and follow up with them after you've recognized and responded to your opportunity. The first step to it is being willing to recognize the opportunity. I want you to think about the Good Samaritan very quickly. Luke 10. 25 through 37 is the Good Samaritan. In the Good Samaritan, we see a perfect example of not being willing to recognize the opportunity in someone that was. One of the Levite and the priest came by, and they saw this man on the side of the road, and they had the opportunity to change his life. They could have helped him out. They didn't have to do that much. They could have helped him out, picked him up, dressed his wounds, sent him on his way. But then you get this Samaritan that we talk about a lot of times, and this Samaritan comes, and he comes about his way, and he sees this man on the side of the road, a man that he's not even supposed to be associated with, and he stops and he goes out of his way. He doesn't just say, sir, I hope you get to feeling better. I'll pray for you. He says, sir, I hope you get better. I'll pray for you. But let me help you out. Let me dress your wounds. Let me take you to the inn. I'm going to pay for your food. I'm going to pay for your bed, your meals. And then he tells the innkeeper, he says, whatever else, however long he needs to stay here, let him stay. And I'll be back to fix it. I'll be back to pay for it. And so you've got to be willing to recognize the opportunity in life. A point that I like to make out of this is helping someone and asking what's in it for me isn't kindness. That's a business transaction. Doing something for someone and saying, you're going to owe me later. Or like the guy in Boaz, when Boaz was talking to Ruth, he says, look, I found another guy who's related closer to you, and he can be your kinsman redeemer. He's next in line before I am. And that guy was like, great, this is going to be a good deal for me. I'm going to get some land. I'm going to get all this stuff. This is great. And then he finds out that he's got to do something else, and he says, no, that's not for me. That's not going to work out in my favor. Helping someone and asking what's in it for me is not kindness. That's a business transaction. And so when we go through these things, something that I have to do in my life, we're going to talk about here in a minute, two things that keep us from being a Boaz. But before we do that, we're going to get some perspective. Whenever I asked at the very beginning, I said, why do we want to be a Boaz? I gave you the Great Commission. You know, Matthew 25, God gives us the Great Commission to go into all the world and be a Boaz in people's lives, basically. Go help people, give them the Word of God. Well, getting some perspective is what always helps me whenever I need to kind of step back and reevaluate what I'm doing. So as we go throughout this, I hope you'll pay attention to this. I'm going to try and give you some numbers here. I can do a little math to get this for you, which is not good. But there are 7.4 billion people, somewhere around that, in the world today. Somewhere around 7.4 billion people. Out of those 7.4 billion people, 1 billion of them profess a belief in Jesus Christ. That's denominations. That's somebody just has to say the words, I believe that Jesus was alive at some point. Or I believe that God is real. And they are put into that figure of 1 billion people. Out of those 1 billion people, if 1 billion people went all, into all the world right now and was a Boaz in someone's life and followed the Great Commission and did what we were supposed to be doing every day of our life, if 1 billion people went into the world, each of us would have to baptize 3.5 people to fulfill the Great Commission all the way. 3.5 people. I know you can't baptize that person, but that's the math. The 3.5 people. So if 1 billion went to all the world right now, today, tonight, and tomorrow, and they wanted to bring 3.5 people each to Christ, we all did our equal share. But if you look at it from this perspective, 7.4 billion people in the world, 2 million of them are members of the church. Only 2 million. If 2 million members of the church all went out and did their equal share in helping bring people to Christ and being a Boaz in people's lives, each of us would have to baptize 3,700 people today to get 7.4 billion people going to heaven. 3,700 people. How many people have you baptized? How many people have you sat down and had a Bible study with and said, look, this is the greatest thing that has ever been made, and just showed them the excitement and the love that you find from Christ? How many people have you done that with? 3,700 people. This next image is a picture of a 90-year life. If you can see it, yeah. It kind of says birth right there at the top, your 30th birthday, somewhere in the middle there, your 60th birthday, and you turn 90 right there at the end. I saw this, I can't remember where I saw it. I think it was on the internet, on Facebook maybe. But it's something that I kind of look at. I have on my phone now that I use sometimes when I want to get some perspective. The illustration that I think of is, this is a 90-year life in weeks. There are 4,692.86 weeks in your life. That's something that gets me perspective when I'm losing sight of what's important. 90 years sounds like a long time, but you can take that 90 years and go ahead and cut that. I'm 19 years old, so I'm somewhere up there. And out of those 19 years that I've been on earth, if I take and I say I want to bring one person to Christ a week, I've got 7 days to bring one person to Christ. How many of those circles will be filled in my life? If I look at a 90-year life where I'm dedicated to Christ, at the age of 12 or 13, I was baptized. And I look at 90 years and I say, every week I want to bring one person to Christ. I know it's not about setting a quota and saying, I want to meet this number. But if I just did that, am I doing that? Could I fill in every circle? Say, well, this week I've taken someone to Christ. I've allowed God to work through me and bring someone. That's a reality shaker for me sometimes when I look at it. We have to start acting like the city set on a hill that we are, like the light of the world that we are. The story of Boaz is so powerful because you see this man who went out of his way. He gave up himself. Boaz could have done what we do so many times throughout the day whenever just 2 days ago, I messaged a friend who's at another school, and I said, "How's school going? I haven't seen you in a while. I miss you." And he dropped something heavy on me, and the next text he sent after that was like, "Hey, I'm not trying to drop something heavy on you, but I just want to let you know that's what's going on in my life." He was telling me about how he was struggling and stuff, and we had a phone call after that. But he could have told me, he could have told me what was going on in his life and everything that's happening, and I said, "Man, you know, that's horrible. I hate that's happening, and I hate that, you know, life's being that way. I hope you get it figured out. I'll say a prayer for you." And that'd been it. But he asked if he could call me, and we had a phone call, and we talked, and we you know, tried to give each other advice about things going on in our lives, and we decided to meet up and do some things. And if we're to act like the city on a hill in the light of the world, then whenever people tell us things that are going on in their lives, whenever we see people at work, see people at school, see people in the classroom, people in the dorms, they're being silent, they're being apart from people, they're being, you know, they're in a bad mood, we need to go out of our way to help them. So what stops me from being a Boaz? We're almost to the end here. What stops me from being a Boaz? Number one, approval of man is one of the first things that I think of when I say, what stops me from being a Boaz? Does it not hurt you to think that there are people in this world, possibly people in this room right now, who will not go to heaven? Does it not hurt you to think that? It almost puts me to tears whenever I think that somebody's not going to make it to heaven. Whenever I think about my grandfather, who's not a member of the church, and whenever he passes away, if I don't do something about it, he may not make it to heaven. Whenever I think about the people who live on the second floor of Benson who may not make it to heaven because they don't have God's word and they aren't baptized, and no one's shown them this gift that we have, and they may not make it to heaven. And one of those things that stops me from doing that is because I'm so scared of the approval of man. If you look at Galatians, make sure I get it right, 1:10, there we go. Galatians 1:10. For am I now seeking the approval of man or of God? Or am I trying to please man? If I were still trying to please man, I would not be a servant of Christ. Whenever I think about people in my life, that I'm supposed to go out of my way, and I'm supposed to go to them, and I'm supposed to open up my Bible, I'm supposed to say, "Look, I may be 19 years old, I may not have all this wisdom and knowledge, I may not have much money to give you, I may not be able to do all these things for you, but I'll tell you what I can do. I've got this Bible right here, and I can open this, and I can show you the greatest gift that has ever been given to mankind. I can show you this, and this will change your life in ways you could never think about. It could change your life, not until you die, the day you die, until after you die, for the rest of eternity. That is how important this is." And I feel like sometimes we lose sight of that, and I was trying to give you some perspective and say that there are 7.4 billion people in the world, and only 2 million of them are members of the church. And out of those 2 million, how many of them are going to heaven? We've got to keep the perspective. But we can't worry about the approval of man. Because whenever I want to go have a Bible study with somebody, and I think, you know, what are they going to think about me? How am I going to say this? How am I going to approach them? You know, I make excuses all the time for people that are in Phi Kappa, or they're all over this campus. And I say, well, you know, that's somebody else's job to go meet with them. That's somebody, you know, I don't even know how I'm going to start it with them. I don't know how I'm going to bring the word across to them. I'm scared of rejection, that they're going to say no to me. I'm scared that they won't like me. They'll think I'm weird, that I'm going to be an enemy to them. And then I also found myself saying, you know, no matter what, at the end of the day, I love God so much that no matter what man says, I'm going to share the word of God. And I feel like sometimes that's not true because I am so scared of what people think. We've got to stop worrying about what people think and start worrying about what God thinks and about what's really going to matter, and keep this perspective, because there's lives that need to be saved. The second thing that stops us from being Boaz is selfishness. Is a culture of selfishness. Whenever I think about my life, whenever you wake up in the morning, think to yourself, what do you do? Whenever you wake up in the morning, what's the first thing that you do whenever you wake up? And then think about the first 5 things that you do whenever you wake up. When you wake up in the morning, do you say a prayer to God? Do you say, God, today I've got this, this, and this going on, and I want you to help me through it, God. God, I've got all these things going on, and I really need some help right now. Or do you not even say a prayer? You just sit here and you wake up, you're tired, you don't even want to go to class, you don't even want to go to work. You're about to just dredge through that day. And you know all the things that you've got going on, all the tests, all the deadlines, all the people you've got to meet with that you don't really want to talk to, and all the different things that you've got to do. I ask you this because think about the first things you do in the morning. The first thing that you do in the morning is typically going to be an indicator for how you live your life throughout the rest of that day. If you wake up in the morning, you say, God, not what can you do for me, how can you help me today? You say, God, I just want to say a prayer real quick. no matter what I come through today, work through me. Allow me to let you into my life and work through me. Allow me to see the opportunities today wherever I'm at, not be caught up in myself, and not be thinking about how much fun can I have today in class, if not the dent, you know, how good of a grade can I get, how many times, you know, how much do I need to study, instead of worrying about all these things that are important. They are important. They're not as important as lost souls. But if you wake up in the morning, you say that prayer, and you say, God, work through me and allow me to recognize those opportunities and respond to them, and not just shrug them off and let somebody else do that and be a bystander to people's lives falling apart. If you do that, throughout the day, you will start to live your life the right way. One of the last points I want to make is this. One of the most important things, out of all the information we've gone through about being willing to recognize opportunities, recognizing opportunities, responding to your opportunities, and following through and following up with your opportunities, is this. Being a Boaz is all about your relationships. Being a Boaz is all about your relationships. For some reason in the church, so many times we give off this mindset that if we want to bring people to Christ, we have to preach to the masses. And so we get this mindset of, I've got to go 30 miles wide and 1 inch deep. We've got to go 30 miles wide and 1 inch deep. I've got to talk to as many people as possible. I need to get up in the pulpit and I need to preach. Something I've been told and something I'm starting to learn and find out is that a lot of souls being saved doesn't happen from here. It happens out there. It happens out in the world and how you treat people and the relationships you build with people. If we look at Christ and the way that he lived his life while he was here on earth, he lived his life the exact opposite of this. I give this example of dirt right here. Because I say 30 miles wide and 1 inch deep, because we look at the surface, we see all these people, and we see them, and that's all we see. And we see their clothes, we see their faces. And if Jesus Christ came in on a Tuesday night, and he was in a Bible study, or he was up in the Sweet Devo in Benson that we have on the second floor, and he was in that room, he wouldn't be looking at everybody and seeing the clothes that we're wearing. He wouldn't see, you know, how out of shape I am, or, you know, the mole in your face, or that your hair is messy. He wouldn't see all these things that we look at people and we judge them for. Jesus Christ is going to see something else. He's going to see this picture. Jesus Christ is going to see 1 mile wide and 30 inches deep instead of 30 miles wide and 1 inch deep. If Jesus, whenever he looks at us, he doesn't see somebody and judge them for what they look like. He's not concerned about what you look like on the outside. He's concerned about what you look like on the inside. He wants to know your story. He understands that you are a child of God. Jesus knows that you're a person just like he was. You're living through this earth, going through temptations just like I am. And he sees the story from all the things that you've done since you were a little kid to the time that you've grown up, whatever age you are now, and everything that you've been through and everything that's happened to you in your life, and the way that you've responded to that has made you who you are today. And that's how he sees you, and that's how we need to see people. The most important thing about being a Boaz is your relationships. If you think about Boaz, in the book of Ruth, the first thing he did is he walked over to his servant and he said, who is this? What is her story? He found out her story. And the servant explained his story. And then he, instead of just saying, well, you know, that's horrible. I hate that that's happening to her. He responded. He recognized. He responded. And he followed through and followed up with her. And he helped her entire family get out of a hole that they were in. Very quickly, I want to tell you one last thing. This is it. And we'll go. I know I'm over a little. But one last thing. There's a story that I found recently about a prolific writer named Ernest Hemingway. You probably know who that is. But Ernest Hemingway, as the story goes, was one day sitting at lunch with some colleagues of his, some associates, some fellow authors, and they were sitting there at lunch and they were talking and whatnot, and one of the authors brought up very quickly, they said, you know, Ernest, I'm going to bet you $10 right now that you cannot write a 6-word short story. I hate writing, quite honestly. I don't enjoy doing it. I just don't like writing papers. But even doing short stories, I remember back in high school, that was one of the hardest things, was always trying to write short stories. And they bet Ernest $10 that he could not write an entire short story in 6 words. But Ernest Hemingway, being the genius that he is with words, he took the bet. And he said, all right. And he came over and he grabbed a napkin off the table and pulled the pen out of his pocket and he began to write. On that napkin. And on that napkin, he wrote 6 words that are a very profound story. He wrote the 6 words that said, baby shoes for sale, never worn. 6 words, baby shoes for sale, never worn. That is a very powerful story for 6 words. And I think a lot of times in life, we've got a lot of six word stories coming our way. Maybe in your life, you've received a six word story that came in the form of a phone call, and someone said there has been a terrible accident. Maybe in your life, or in my life, your six word story is that the cancer isn't responding to treatment. Your six word story is that you are not able to conceive. Your six word story is that I just want to be friends. Your six word story is I'm leaving. The marriage is over. Your six word story in your life is I'm struggling with addiction. Or maybe your six word story is here's a rose off the casket. All throughout life, we have things going on in our lives. Things coming at us, Satan hurls things at us, life. The natural things that happen are happening, and we just, those things hit us so hard. And if we want to allow it, God's going to stick a Boaz in our life. So when I ask you, are you going to be a Boaz in someone's life today? Are you going to be a Boaz in someone's life today? It's whenever someone gives you the opportunity to act in their life, are you going to say a few nice words? A few nice words can change someone's day. But a few nice actions can change someone's entire life. If you're a Christian here this evening and you feel like you've got a lot of things going on in your life, life's throwing things at you, you're in a place that you don't need to be. You feel like you're not being the Boaz that you need to be in people's lives. You're going through every day and all you're doing is thinking about yourself. You've got the schedule and you're hitting it off. You're going to one thing after the next. You've got these tests to go through. You've got these appointments to go to. You've got all these things to do and you're not thinking about anybody but yourself. And maybe you've realized that or not. And you want to try and be better. You want to try and live every day and you're 90 your life or however long your life is. And bring as many people to Christ every day and every week that you can. And that every day when you walk by somebody, instead of just putting your head down and walking by not saying anything, you're going to look at them, you're going to smile and say, hey, how are you? You're going to listen to somebody when they need you to listen, like Job's friends did. After he had three messengers come up, one after another, and tell him about how his entire wealth, his livestock, and all of his children had been taken away. And his friends came and sat with him for a week and listened. And they just sat there and they were there with him. Are you going to go out of your way and follow up, follow through with people and do what they need to do? Do what you need to do to help them. And make a difference in life. If you need to find the purpose that God has set for you in life, let us help you. I believe that you have a great church family here at Hendo that's going to be a Boaz in your life if you need it. If you need encouragement to live better, to do better every day, every time you go somewhere to live better. And maybe if you're not a Christian here tonight, and you realize that you've got a lot of things going on in your life, and you want the security and the freedom of knowing that you have Christ, and that at the end of the day, there's always one thing for sure, is that I've got God. And I've got eternity with Him, but I've got to look forward to. If you need someone to be a Boaz here in your life tonight, if you need someone to be life-changing and do things for you, please come now as we stand and as we sing.